Let's set a motivation for our time together for this next little while and for the day. You know, first reflecting on whatever it was that brought you here this morning. Why are you here? And then whatever good reason it was that made you take some time on a beautiful Sunday morning to come sit in a meditation hall with a group of like-minded seekers, we can widen that motivation to think for a little bit that when we come together to explore philosophical topics, to explore ourselves, it has a very positive effect on our own minds. So that's one good reason for being here. And another good reason is that when we have these positive effects in our own minds, it affects how we are in relationship to others. So we can imagine the people that we work with, or the people that we live with, people we come in contact with every day, humans and animals, and just send a wish or an intention that whatever it is that we learn or explore together today will also be of benefit to them very directly. Not because we'll go home and fix them, but because through our positive actions on ourselves, it enriches and enhances the positive energy in the relationships with people around us. And we can take it a step further and just realize that as a group gathered here together, we're creating a lot of positive energy just in general. And so we can hold the aspiration that by our coming together and exploring the Buddha's teachings today, the ripple effect will reach out and touch every living being, mitigating suffering in some way, bringing them greater happiness. And that ultimately what we're doing today will plant the seeds that ripen in our own minds and hearts to become completely awake, cultivate all of our good qualities endlessly so that we can really be of benefit to others. So let's hold that thought. So welcome again, newcomers and some long-time old-comers. I'm Thupten Chinny, and with our Sharing the Dharma Day series, we're following the text of a book that we don't have here, but is in the house, called Taming the Mind, by our founder and Apis, Thupten Chodron. So we're in the second or third chapter, I'm not sure. But were anybody here last time? Yeah, a couple. Okay, good. So there is a continuity to this, but it stands alone. So I just want to give you a little context for where we are in today's talk, because last time the topic was to look at our condition as human beings and really take an assessment at how precious our opportunity is right now. It's something that we don't generally think about. We're well aware of the things that don't work in our lives. But the topic was around helping us look differently at the situation that we're in right now, so that we can really begin to use our lives in a way that's meaningful. So one of the things that we usually take for granted, of course, but it's something we're thinking about, is we are human. We are not mayflies. We are not toads. We have a human body. We have a human intelligence. And so, and our understanding of the way the world works, we haven't always been human. We won't always be human. But right now, we are. And so that's something to really rejoice about and to take advantage of in terms of making our lives really meaningful right now. Another thing that we have going for us is that all of our minds work pretty well. Our personal neuroses aside, but they work. And our bodies work. Our senses function. We can hear, see, smell, taste, so we can experience the world. And most importantly, we can actually really think about our situation and have the intelligence and all of the senses capable to be able to cultivate our good qualities. People here have a great thing going for them in that there's a spiritual interest or a spiritual longing. So we're not just materialists. But there's something in this, in every person who showed up for this kind of thing, that there's a broad, you're looking for something broader, something larger than ourselves to make our lives meaningful, or we wouldn't be here. And so to see that as we look around the people that we know and love and care about, actually that quality is kind of rare. You know, very good-hearted people don't around us, but they don't all necessarily have this particular bent. And so that makes also an opportunity to really pursue that in this life. Just on a real physical level, everybody here has clothes on. So I'd say that we all ate breakfast probably, or at least could have. We're sheltered. We have, you know, so we have the basic amenities in life. Not every human being does. So we have these conditions to... that allow us to pursue our interest in spirituality, or whatever it is that we call that, whatever we call that longing. We have these conditions that are possible. We happen to live in a country where we have religious freedom, so we can pursue that. And these days, there are books, there are qualified teachers, so there's lots of opportunities to actually learn and explore these. So if we think about all those advantages of the situation that we're in right now, we see that there's some really quite precious things going on for us that not every human being on the planet has, and not every creature on the planet has. So it can begin to help us focus about, well, what's of value in my life? So today's topic takes that a step further. And looks at it from the other side, because we get to look at how short that opportunity is, how very, very brief. So today our topic is preparing for the future, death and rebirth. So people who would come to a day themed on death, I think, are quite unusual. So I commend everybody for coming in the first place. Because generally speaking, that is not something we want to talk about. It's not something we want to think about. I think, you know, there's a lot of reasons for that, and maybe good reasons. You know, in general, it's frightening for most of us. We don't know where we're going. We don't really know what's going to happen. So, or maybe there's a fear of pain and anguish at the time of death, so it's like not think of it is one thing. Some people have a really strong belief that if you think about it, if you talk about it, you actually bring it on. So like not talking about it would mean it wouldn't happen. They don't know. But it is actually a very, very strong belief. So there's, you know, lots of avoidance going on there. But not only in the Buddhist teachings, but I think most spiritual traditions actually teach that the opposite is really true. I mean, not that by talking about it we avoid it, but that talking about death, preparing for death, really thinking about death actually can bring a lot of joy into our lives. Because the truth is, it is inevitable. It is something every single one of us is going towards moment by moment by moment by moment. And so just like... I don't know if you've ever given a talk before a public group, but you rehearse the talk. It goes better than if you don't. If you are going on a trip and you kind of read the guidebooks and think about how you're going to get from the airport to the hotel, it goes better than if you don't. And so the whole topic of thinking about death and reflecting on it is just like that. On one level, it's just like rehearsing for something that is definitely going to happen. So planning for it, looking at what it might lead to, really has some advantages in how we live our life. Because we, you know, if we know it's going to happen, then we start thinking about, as Venerable Jigme was leading this morning, what's important then? It helps us make those kinds of decisions. If we know it's going to happen, then we really will plan for it. If we really think about that it's going to happen, then it's also a great tool for subduing some of our afflicted mind state. You know, we won't be so maybe caught up in the petty details of life, but we'll actually be more focused on the big picture and what's important, if we can keep it in mind. And then another great advantage of thinking about death is we have a verse that we chant that every day that has this reminder, consciousness, the guest, will leave the guest house of the body. So there's a Tibetan phrase that I can't remember how it goes right now, but it's the idea that our consciousness is just sort of on a trip, and this body is the hotel. So don't get too, you don't have to redecorate too much because you ain't here long. It keeps us from holding on then so tightly to the things that we want to hold tightly to. Keeps that idea in mind. There's a beautiful quote here that I wanted to... Venerable Chödrén in her book does a quote that I liked, but then I went to look for something else, and I found this one, which is a beautiful image to really keep in mind. This is quoting the Buddha, who said this. This existence of ours is as transient as autumn clouds. To watch the birth and death of beings is like looking at the movements of a dance. A lifetime is like a flash of lightning in the sky, rushing by like a torrent down a steep mountain. A lifetime is like a flash of lightning in the sky. So, useful to think about. Because it's so easy for us to forget about it. It's so distant. You know, none of us, I mean, we all know logically that we're going to die, but none of us really thinks we're going to die. I mean, I am me. I have always been me. I will always be me. I mean, that, if I just think about it emotionally, you know, if I sort of get in touch with it here somewhere in the lower part of my body, that's the way I feel. I've always been me. I'm always going to be me. So what's to stop? I mean, we'll just keep going and going and going and going and going. And the world around us in particular, in our culture, supports that. You know, how many, I would venture to say, I cannot say that this is true, but I would venture to say that the developments in plastic and cosmetic surgeries are, you know, that kind of technology is just soaring these days. What is that? To stave off, or an attempt to stave off, our eventual aging and death. You know, try to put it off as long as possible. Of course, we know that it won't work. There's a billboard in Coeur d'Alene. I don't know if it's still there. It was up there forever for some plastic surgeon's office. That there's a beautiful young face that says something like, defy time. And that's very appealing. Well, let's defy time, you know? Or even if we think we are going to die, we think, well, you know, I've got another 30, 40, 50 years. So this, but is that true? We don't know. We have no idea. So the idea of thinking about death is just really valuable. Not because death itself is so special, or because death itself is a big monolith that we want to hold up as a thing that we're marching towards, that's the goal of the, but because by looking at that inevitability, it helps really enhance what we're doing with the life we have right now. So that's quite the point. Yeah, nobody thinks they're going to die. Even people with terminal illnesses don't think they're going to die. Even people who have terminal illnesses and fairly well accept that they probably are going to die don't think they're going to die today. Mostly we just don't. So this teaching has helps us think about death in a way that over and over and over seems to me its whole purpose is to help penetrate the thick, thick wall of denial that we have about it so that we can use the teaching to really propel us to do the things that are meaningful. So the very first point of this penetrating the thick wall of our denial is just the fact that death is definite. Thinking about it over and over again, death is definite. Nobody ever got out of this alive. Ever. Even the Buddha died. Even Jesus died. Even His Holiness the Dalai Lama is going to die. I mean, you can think of the most developed spiritual beings that there have ever been. They all died. The most powerful military leaders, the most powerful everything. So why in the world do I think I'm not? Why do I have that idea? So under that point, you know, it's useful to think about what is death anyway. Exactly. Now there's a wonderful phrase that's been circulating the internet for a while that defines life as a sexually transmitted terminal condition. Which is true, right? Is that very accurate? Sexually transmitted and terminal. So you can say that death is like then the cessation. The termination of that condition. What happens is this consciousness that has been thinking since the moment of your conception, for sure, and before, one thought follows another, follows another, follows another, follows another, follows another. At the moment of conception, a sperm and an egg come together, which are material. A moment of that consciousness, your stream of consciousness, enters that, and so begins what we call this life. So your consciousness develops, the fetus develops, you get born, you have all the experiences that you have in your life that kind of get accumulated in your mind, all the positive actions that we've done, all the positive motivations that we've had, all the good qualities that we've developed, all the kindnesses we've done, all leave a little trace on that consciousness. And then all the negative actions we've done, all of the harmful things that we've done, all of the bad motivations that we have, bad in terms of like extremely selfish or extremely harmful wishes, also leave a little trace on that consciousness. So we're accumulating thought, accumulating traces in that mind stream. And so eventually, inevitably, everything that comes together must part, right? So eventually that union of consciousness, which has its own continuity, and the material continuity of sperm and egg, atoms and molecules, blood, cells, bones, and so forth, separate. At that moment of separation is what we call death. Our consciousness continues on. One thought following another, following another, following another, following another, following another, in an endless stream like it has since beginningless time. And this body that we so identify as ourselves becomes what? Ashes, worm food, whatever. The elements of earth, water, fire, and air are, you know, back into the system of elemental things, and who knows what the continuity of the body becomes. It just goes on and changes and changes and changes. The continuity of the consciousness goes on into our next life. And all of those seeds, all of those traces of the negative actions or the harmful actions, the positive and virtuous actions that we've done, go with us and ripen in the next life as both our lives, the kind of life that we have when we're reborn, and also the experiences that we have when we're reborn, and the habits that we have that come up when we're reborn. So death is that moment of separation from body and mind in a real kind of gross level. Totally, I mean, if we think about it logically, it's totally reasonable. Of course that's going to happen. So death is definite. If you have a body and mind, a consciousness and a mind, a body and a consciousness that come together, it will separate. And at that time of death, nothing, no bargaining can change it. You know that song that came out of that movie, oh death, please spare me over for another year. Well, that's a great prayer. But at the moment of death, it actually, there's nothing we can do. We can't add life. And so the reality of impermanence, of things changing constantly moment to moment, is that with every breath, we're actually moving closer to our death. Every single breath. Which can be a terrifying thought, and it can also be a very liberating thought to really think about how things are moving, just being aware of the flow of everything. You know, if we put it in that context, then our consciousness and our own death and our own breathing is just a part of the flow of everything that happens in the universe, which is constantly changing. So we're quite interconnected in that way. So it's good to think of it that way rather than, oh no, with every breath I'm dying. Because we just are. And there's a tremendous relief that comes with the acceptance of that, I think. So then realizing that death is certain, the conclusion of that particular series of thoughts is that therefore we will practice the Dharma. So we need to talk about what does Dharma mean? What does that mean? Therefore, we'll practice the Dharma. Why? Who cares? The kind of in a real simple term, practicing the Dharma in this context means that being aware that all of those traces that we place on our mind stream, all of those traces left over from our negative and positive actions, by setting our mind towards the activities, the thoughts, the motivations that plant those positive seeds, we are preparing for our future. We are creating the causes for our happiness in the future. We are creating the causes for our own good qualities to continue to grow in the future. So, in a kind of a gross way, practicing the Dharma, whether it's through Buddhist Dharma or whether it's through any spiritual pursuit, practice is planting those seeds of positive actions and virtues, caring for others, cultivating our love, cultivating our compassion, cultivating our wisdom, practicing generosity, and working to overcome our anger, our jealousy, all the things we all have, you know, our clinging, our craving, feeding our addictions, the things that we tend to sort of mindlessly go towards. When we're working to cultivate the positive and try to reduce or minimize the negative tendencies in our own minds, then that's the kind of practicing the Dharma that we want to do in this life, because we know we're going to die. We know we're going to die and carry the seeds of what we did in this life forward with us. Right? So you following me? So that's where this conclusion takes us to. It's okay, I'm definitely going to die. Therefore, I need to practice the Dharma. In other words, therefore, I really want to prepare for my death in future lives by doing the things that will benefit this mind stream in the future. And that means benefiting others and cultivating my good qualities. So, in a way, I find that a more compelling reason to be a good person than just because I went to Sunday school and the Sunday school said, you need to be good.
because you need to be good somehow makes it feel like, oh my God, sort of I'm bad, I'm terrible. That's the opposite of being good, is being really terrible and evil. But this has a different feeling. This has, oh, so if I can work on being what I would call a good person, if I can think about what is it that I think, what is it that I think or can learn that are positive actions, keeping good ethics, that sort of thing, then there's a stronger motivation even that isn't about being good or bad, but it is about having a positive result in the future. Different motivation. Yeah? So then that takes us to the second point, because you can say, yes, that's great, I really want to do that, and I really want to practice Dharma, I really want to study, but right now I am really focused on my family, or right now I am really focused on my career, or I'll do that when I retire. I know that in India that's kind of the thing, is that after you live your whole life, you go off and become a spiritual seeker at your retirement. But that is sort of predicated on the promise that you will live to retirement. And so the second point is that the time of our death is completely uncertain. We don't know, actually, when it's going to come. It is very comforting, I find it very comforting, to sometimes think, oh, you know, 85, 90, 95, that's a good time to die. I mean, I think about that a lot. Sort of calculate, okay, how much time do I have left? 85. But we have no idea. And so it's very, very important, if we're going to be thinking about death and really using this to help us focus our life, it is really important to add this piece that we don't have any idea. The time is completely unknown. You know, I think in this day and age, lifespan is, we've gotten more comfortable with the statistics. Although, actually, I just saw one recently. It's lower than I thought it was. I thought it had gotten up into the 80s, but maybe it's something like 78 for Americans. But regardless, it's still no guarantee. That's just an actuarial table. You may fit that. You may not. People die at all ages. And we all know people who have. Don't we know children who were never born? No. We know young people. Martha was just telling me about your niece, right? 42 years old, died of cancer. Two young children. I mean, she didn't expect to die. Of course we don't expect to die. Many, many, now that I'm getting to be rather quite middle-aged, I know lots and lots of people who died at a much younger age than I am right now, including my own dad. You know, I've already outlived my father by many, many years. So to think with any kind of certainty that, oh, we've got time, is just as deluded, really, as thinking we're not going to die at all, because we never know. Again, the point is not to scare us so that we're always, I'm going to die today, I might die today, but to have an idea that says, I might die today. What do I need to do? What do I need to do in terms of my relationships with people around me? What do I need to clear up? What do I need to forgive? What do I need to let go of? What do I need to repair? What do I want to think about, given that I could die today, tomorrow, next week? How do I want to be spending my time? So it's useful to think about it. Another point that kind of helps bring it all home is that it takes more effort to stay alive than it does to just die. And you know, I mean, I don't ever think about this. There is so much that we do that we take for granted that we don't at all think about, I'm doing this to stay alive. But we are. I mean, we spend so much energy throughout the day. Like eating, for example. I mean, we can get quite into the taste of it. We can get into growing our own food and make that, and we think that's all a pleasurable thing. But the bottom line is, we don't eat, we die. So a huge amount of energy goes into not just
the food itself or shopping or preparing it or growing it, but then we have to have jobs or something so that we can actually procure it. So we spend our time doing that. Not that that's a waste of time, but we get distracted into all the bits and pieces and we don't really think about, oh, I am doing this to stay alive. I'm having a job to stay alive. I'm having a job so that I and my family can stay alive. There are many other fulfilling reasons to do our work, for sure. But there's that kind of bottom line. We're doing things to stay alive. Same thing with shelter. You know, we build beautiful homes and pick marmoleum for the floor and we do all this kind of stuff. But bottom line, I guess if we were still living in caves, we would be more closely connected to the fact that you know, if we didn't have that shelter, the elements would eventually kill us. These winters are grim around here. You want a house. You want something. You want to be inside of something. So even those things that we just kind of take for granted as a way of life, these are things that we're doing to keep ourselves alive. Then we're exercising. We're making sure that we're taking good care of what we eat, how we eat. The older you get, you take fewer and fewer risks on motorcycles and cars, most people. But then even that's no guarantee, because things that are generally designed to help us, like our homes, can also then ultimately be the cause of our death. The earthquake comes and that beam is on your head, and that takes us out too. And even little tiny things, you know, our little viruses, little these sorts of things, those come at any time. Anytime. And our body's quite fragile. We think that we're pretty tough, but as soon as something surprising, oh, Venerable Jigme once told me something I can't get out of my head, of a patient she had who was struck by a thorn and died of tetanus. I think that is such an amazing thing to think about. Such a tiny little thing. But when the moment comes, not that every single one of us who ever gets touched by a thorn is going to die, but when the time comes, that those are the things that can trigger it. So our time of death is completely unknown. That's really the point of this whole list of all the things that can kill us, is to really think about the fact that it could come at any moment. Therefore, understanding that, we will practice the Dharma or do those things that are beneficial or without procrastinating. We'll just get on it. A story that I quite love, it had a very powerful effect in my own decision to become a nun, was a woman who visited here, was also by then a nun. She went home for lunch one day, like she had done from work, went home from lunch every day, like she had every day, made herself a lunch, and she made some couscous and vegetables or whatever. And as she was just eating lunch, kind of mindlessly, all of a sudden this clunk of couscous got caught in her windpipe. She breathed in, and there was this little wad of, you know, and you don't think of couscous as kind of diabolical until you imagine it lodged in your windpipe. But, and it was stuck, and she's there alone. And she said, so she's working with it, like trying to get it up. And then she said, I'm going to die. And her very next thought was, I can't believe I'm going to die without being a nun. And so she gave herself a Heimlich, and she said it just flew across the room. And she was so shocked even that she would have that thought, that she wanted to devote her life to the Dharma in that way. I mean, she thought about it. It wasn't like it came from nowhere. But in that moment when she thought she was going to die, I was like, I can't believe I'm not going to be a nun. So the next time when I saw her, she actually was a nun. But the point there was that she took this right to the point of really feeling like she was dying before she realized that this aspiration for her was really clear and it was something she needed to do before she died. So we all have something in there that we aspire to or desire that we want before we die, whether of all kinds of things. And maybe they're kind of hidden. But especially in terms of like this sort of Dharma practice, you know, people say, oh, I want to do a long retreat, for example. but I'll wait. Well, we don't know. I want to go study with the Dalai Lama, but I'll wait. So those are just kinds of examples of how to not use our postponing the things that are meaningful in terms of our growth, our development, or especially our spiritual development. Because we don't know how much time we have. We don't know. And then the final point in all of this, as you can see, is driving us towards practicing Dharma. Right? Driving us towards that. So the third point is that at the time of death, actually nothing helps us but the Dharma that's in our minds. So what does that mean? Well, it means, first of all, that at the moment of death, our wealth, all the stuff that we've worked to accumulate, our beautiful houses, our beautiful stuff, although it's lovely, at that moment, it's not going with us. We can't do anything with it. We can give it away. But in terms of actually helping us in that moment of letting go, we can't buy our way out. We can't bargain with anybody. There's nobody to pay. So it just points to the fact of if we spend our whole life really focusing on accumulating that, it doesn't go with us. Then the second thought is neither do our family and friends, which is often the place that we think is the very most important things in our lives. And they are. This is not to undermine that concept. The people around us are very important. But our clinging to the people around us is only going to cause more pain and suffering at the time of death. And hospice nurses, people who work with the dying, actually note a phenomenon that people often wait till a family is out of the room to die. Very, very often. So that, this kind of hanging, just even the energy of hanging on and don't want to let them go at the time of death doesn't help. And in fact, if we are definitely separating from the body, the consciousness is moving on, and we don't want to go, that clinging and grasping at the people we love brings a kind of a negative, painful mind state. So that we're not dying peacefully. We're dying painfully, clinging. So again, spending our whole lives cultivating those relationships, they're important. But to make them 100% of importance, then what do we have at the time of death? Nobody can go. They'd love to. Well, I don't know if they'd love to. They'd love for you to stay. But can't. We're gone. We're on our way. And then thirdly, even our precious bodies don't go. That's exactly what death means, right? Body stays here, mind goes on. So this form that we have relied on for everything. We get angry often when it even gets sick. We're so used to it's supposed to be working a certain way. But at the time of death, it's just shutting down. So it doesn't go either. So all of these lead us to an understanding that practicing the Dharma without worldly motivation of wealth or fame or whatever, but really doing it from an open-hearted place that aspires for the highest potential that we can have. Aspires for us to develop ourselves to a state of great love and compassion. That is all that goes with us. And at the moment of death, it's actually all that helps us. So I really thought about this. Now, how does Dharma help us at the time of death? What does that mean? It's a nice little phrase in the longer meditation, but how does it help us? For one thing, if we're prepared, we can go peacefully. so that that moment of death that sometimes we're so afraid of will be painful, or we'll have this anguish or this clinging to the people. If we're really prepared, we can go peacefully. They say that really experienced practitioners can meditate their way right out and right into the next life. I doubt I'm going to make that one. But even so, we don't have that level of concentration by the time we die. For sure, the confidence that we have in having spent our life meaningfully, really rejoicing at the things that we've done that are of benefit, rejoicing at the ethical discipline that we've kept in our lives, rejoicing at the kindness, the good things that we've done for others. That kind of mind at the time of death, if we have the training to take ourselves there, can make it quite great. I did a great job. So, okay, I can let go. If we practice the Dharma and have practiced generosity and have the idea of really letting go of all of our material possessions as much as possible, if we've taken care of those kind of things, then we can let go and let them go. We can die peacefully. Same thing with our relationships. You know, if we've been able to forgive, clear up the things that need to be done, things that need to have been said that we wish we had said have now been said, we can die without regret in terms of our relationships as well. So practicing the Dharma helps us in that way too. And if you're a Buddhist, you can take refuge. If you're not a Buddhist, you take refuge in something else, some spiritual being or spiritual concept like love or compassion that you really want to hold in your mind and heart as you die. If we've practiced, if we've habituated our minds to those kinds of things at the time of death, then we can bring those to it. So it doesn't have to be a frightening experience. And then, really most valuably, if we are dying with a peaceful mind, even a joyful mind, then that mind state is what propels us into the next life. So this is really key. The two things that determine where our next life will be are that moment of the thoughts at the moment of death, state our mind is in, and then, this is harder, all of the actions we've accumulated in the life that we've just had, and in previous lives too. So that this thing that we talk about ripening, they come to fruition in what is it the next life that we'll take. So the Buddha described six different realms of existence that we beings who are trapped in cyclic existence will go to. Cyclic existence meaning the situation of having a body and mind that continues on and on and on and on and on. What's the word I want? Anyway, we don't have any choice about it. Choicelessly. Body and mind continuing life after life after life without the realization of the real nature of reality, which it's really the point of the Buddhist teachings, is the way to actually get off this wheel. But without that, then we are compelled or impelled to take rebirth after rebirth after rebirth. And so we only have six realm possibilities. One is a hellish realm, where there is tremendous suffering. One is it's called a hungry gross realm or a preta realm, that is a situation where there is endless craving that can't be sated. That's the suffering of that realm, hunger, thirst, that is very, very difficult to find a cessation for. The animal realm is the realm that we see, so we can see very clearly all of the possibilities for animal rebirths and how much suffering there is there. That includes fishes, that includes birds, that includes insects of every variety, that includes, you know, all the mammals that we can think of. All the sea creatures, zillions of them, different kinds. Then there's a human birth with all the possible permutations of that. There are two realms of god realms. One's a demigod realm and one is a god realm. The demigods are not quite as good as the gods, so they have a lot of jealousy in their mind. And then the god realm is a realm of intense pleasure, which sounds fantastic, except that at the end of their long life, all of a sudden their beautiful bodies, their wonderful sense pleasures and stuff begin to smell and stink, and all of the other gods around them don't want to be anywhere near them, so they're shunned. And then they see where their next rebirth will be, which is way lower than the one that they're in now, and so that's the horror with which they die. So it doesn't sound so pleasant either. The three lower realms, the animal realm, the hungry ghost realm, and the hell realms, are a result of the negative actions of our lives. So the killing, stealing, lying, sexual misconduct, harsh words, idle talk, wrong abuse, divisive speech, you know, all of the nasty stuff that is in our minds has the potential to take us to that kind of rebirth. The positive actions that we do have the potential to take us to human or God realm rebirth. So if we think about these realms, and I think it's kind of hard for us to think about them at first because it's, you know, it's not the way we were raised to think about this. But it is really useful. You know, and often there's the question, are these realms for real? You know, are they just mind states or, you know, what is this? For one thing, they're not permanent. They are all temporary. So it's not like, if we talk about the hell realms, it's not like the hell I grew up with that was somebody sent you there and you were being punished and you were there forever. But it's to think that each of these realms exists based on our own minds. We're the ones that put ourselves there. And when the karma or the time runs out, then we go on to the next life. So it's just like continual. For some people, it's helpful to think about them as simply being mental states. But I've heard the answer too many times when somebody asks that question. My teacher and other teachers have said it is as real as we think our situation is right now. So when we're dreaming, you know, we don't, unless you're a lucid dreamer, we don't really in a dream know that we're dreaming. Until we wake up the next morning and look back and go, oh, that was a dream. So I see the six realms sort of like that. We might be in the middle of the dream. We're in the middle of this dream. We're in the middle of this dream right now and it doesn't feel like a dream. But someday it probably will. But it feels very, very real right now. So those realms are something to think about as a motivator for how do we want to live our lives. That is the bottom line. So again, this whole topic of death isn't about fear. It's not about scaring us into behaving in a certain way. It's not trying to make us conform or, you know, any other ways of trying to control or manipulate people. What the Buddha emphasized here was out of his great compassion was for us to see what's true. To see that this is how it is. And so knowing that this is how it is, we can be quite wise about how we spend our time. We have a lot of choice about where our minds go or what we cultivate in our own minds and hearts. We have tremendous choice about how we spend our time, what we want to do. And so knowing that our death is definite, that the time of death is absolutely unknown, and that nothing helps us at the time of death but the Dharma that we practiced. Nothing goes with us but the seeds, the traces of the actions and thoughts that we've had. Then that's a pretty clear motivation, I think, to make decisions about how we want to live our lives. So that's the whole point of this topic. In the book, Venerable has a little funny little aside, which I thought was interesting, that she says, does that mean Buddhists can't have fun? Buddhists are really boring. They think about death all the time and they don't do things that are fun. No, it doesn't mean that at all. even the things that we talk about in terms of, you know, the wealth doesn't go with you or your family doesn't go with you, it doesn't mean don't have wealth and don't have family. It means paying attention to how we acquire that. So, for example, the example she uses in the book, you know, if certainly you want to provide for your family, for example. So, and we have to. We want to eat. We want to have shelter. But we have an aspiration to be better than the people next door to us. We work super, super hard. We have an opportunity to make a ton of money if we just do this one slightly not so legal thing. Or forget legal, not so kind ethical thing. Not so ethical. So the family gets a better house. But at the time of death, what do you get? The trace of that not so ethical thing that is there and remaining in your mind. So given the fact that we know about what we just talked about, this whole death thing, well, then we'll make a different choice. It's like, okay, I will provide for my family. I will enjoy the things that we have, but we will be content with what we have. There's no need to compete with the neighbors. None. Zero. They have their lives. I have mine. And by making the choice not to do this not quite ethical thing, I'm living up to my own values. I am placing really good seeds on my mind stream. And my family, ultimately, does it matter if we have one more bathroom? Do we need another computer? I mean, you know, all those things that we think we need. So it's like that kind of example. Same thing with family and friends. You know, of course, the people around you are the ones with whom we have the opportunity to practice the Dharma. They're the ones who our love and compassion and willingness to let go of our anger most directly benefits. The difficulty is in the clinging and the craving and the manipulating them to be what they want, what we want them to be, to do what we want them to do. So that's where the practice is tricky. So yes, Buddhists can have fun. Buddhists can enjoy their lives. Buddhists can have good friends. Having good Dharma friends is essential. But doing it without awareness of death helps us be clear about our truth. So that's our topic for today. There's a couple of times for minutes for questions. Anybody have any questions about any of that?
You know, Yenzen, who's from a different set, talks a lot about koan.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if Venerable or anyone in the Dhruva does poa, or is this strictly a Nyingma thing?
I think the lamas do poa. What I've heard Venerable say, I don't know very much about it, but what I've heard Venerable say is that it is indeed a very, it's actually a very advanced practice. And so in this tradition, we don't practice it as a daily basis. We do make prayers for others, and, you know, your lamas and teachers can make that kind of prayer. But to have the capacity, to have the concentration to be able to do that takes a lot. It's a lot. Yeah, you need initiations too, but it's a way high level practice. Oh no! Yeah, all traditions have it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All traditions have it. Yeah. All traditions have it. Yeah.
I was wondering if you could comment. I have a pitfall when I'm thinking about the six realms, and I've heard so many times things like, "Oh, it's really hard to get out of the hungry ghost realm." I just go thinking, and then we have one like, well, it's really hard to get out of it. I'm here, and I've got a precious human rebirth, but I'm probably not going back because I got out of it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And like, kind of like almost patting yourself on the back a little too much.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to avoid,
mm-hmm.
you know, assuming that because you're here now, that must mean that you've got lots of really good seats, because, and that they must continue the next time, and kind of getting over that loophole.
Yeah. It's another kind of denial trip. I mean, I think the more you think, just meditate on this, like meditating on our own lives and doing purification practice. Well, I wanted to mention that. Doing purification practice where you start to really think, if you're doing Vajrasattva or any of the purification practices that begin to help you regret and release the negative traces in your mind, the more you think about what have I actually done in this life? What kind of causes have I really created in this life? You know, think about high school, for example. Think about all the girls you dished, you know. I mean, just life. No big horrible thing. No big crimes. I didn't go out and kill anybody. I didn't steal anything big. A few small things, yes. But, you know, if we go through the list of the 10 negative actions and even look at them quite subtly, what was in my mind? What did I actually do? Then it's another place of getting of clear assessment. This whole path is a lot about clear assessment. So I clearly assess what I've done. Well, then I can see that, in fact, I have created a lot of negative karma already. So I will purify that. I don't want to do those things anymore. I'm taking vows that prevent me from doing that again. But if that's true for this pretty cushy human life, what about before? What about before that? What about I've been taking birth since the beginning of time? What have I done? So I think you have to really think about those things to get over a sort of smugness about having a human life, and so this is probably going to be the way I am now from now on. Because it's easy to go there. Another thing that's useful, one more thing about it, to think about what you might have done, that I think is great, is if, you know, things happen to us all the time that are not so comfortable or pleasant. I mean, just even minor things. So if we think about karma in reverse and think, okay, I'm experiencing this uncomfortable, unpleasant result on the basis of some action I did before, what did I do? Like, one of the things I'm really working with now is I have this sort of anxious personality, which I just do. Well, I'd like to not have that. But what would cause that? Well, I must have just terrorized people at some point in some past life. So what are the ways a person could terrorize people? You could be a hawk and terrorize chickens. You could be a human and terrorize people. And, you know, there's so many ways you could just have terrorized people so that you'd have this sort of basic anxiety as the karmic result. Well, you can start imagining all kinds of negative actions that have been done in the past. So that's using a little bit of an imagination for sure, but I think they're all possible. They're all really possible. So it kind of opens our minds to what we might have done, because we don't know what's sitting in there. We have no idea. Yeah, does that help?
Okay.
Yeah. This is something I kind of get caught up in again and again and come back to it, but in thinking about karma and when you made the comment that at the point of death there's really two determinants for the next rebirth. One is the quality of your mind, and then the other is the karmic seeds that you've created both in this life and previous lives. And just one thing, I don't know, I have a hard time wrapping my head around the significance of the karma from previous lives, given that it's so vast, you know, and even as we do purification, and even as we work with our mind and we try and purify the seeds, it's infinite, if not, countless. Mm. So, you know, whether it's infinite or countless, okay, but still, a huge array, a huge amount. And so, you know, given that we can only really cut the karmic seeds through the realization of emptiness, and we can't really purify it all. In that way, my mind keeps coming back to the idea that, you know, at the time of death, really the most important thing is the quality of your mind. And although that, you know, by purifying and leading the life of a practitioner, you can kind of build the stabilization necessary for that, still, it seems like, does that make sense? And so my question is, you know, does it really matter? The karma quality or components, as opposed to
what's important about thinking about that is it motivates us to make sure that we're creating the best possible actions in this life. Because what's going to ripen, we don't know. And our craving and grasping is what triggers the seeds to ripen that propel us into the next rebirth. And so there's a sequence of which ripens first in the, of the karmic seeds that are fully, that we do all four parts, Karpage is taught on this, right? That have all the four branches that make it a complete karma that would make it propel us into the next rebirth. There is a sequence of which will ripen, and it's like the one that was done most recently, and then the one that is done the most frequently, and then
the heaviest, then the heaviest is first.
Oh, the heaviest is first. Okay, the heaviest is first. Yeah, and then the fourth one is unknown. Yeah, so heaviest, then late, most recent, and then frequency, something like that. So for sure, it makes a difference. If you've spent your whole life really concentrating on practicing virtue, and you've done it with all of the factors that make it a heavy karma, that makes a huge difference, right? So it's those that come to the surface, the order of what comes to the surface is also a factor. So studying what those are and then concentrating on creating those causes has an impact.
And sorry, just to kind of follow up, make sure I'm on the same page. So without the stabilization, you have no control over your mind in terms of what comes up.
All right. Well, you have no, even with stabilization, unless you're able to do the meditations that guide you all the way through the intermediate state, unless you have that level of concentration, we can't control what comes up.
Sure.
But what we can do then is knowing that that which is heavy or that which we are habituated to is what will come up first, then it's maybe a good idea to habituate ourselves to the things that we would like to have come up. Like love and compassion. One of the practices they teach about death that just us ordinary old practitioners can do is the taking and giving meditation. So maybe your concentration's not so great, but you have the thought, may all who are suffering and dying right now, may I take that on me. May I take that on and do it for their benefit. Well, that's the fast prayer. That takes your mind to a whole different place than, oh my God, I'm dying. Me. Extinction. I mean, it's not really extinction, but, that's our terror. But to have the presence of mind, and who knows if we'll have it, but we'll habituate ourselves to that thought, may all that suffering ripen on me right now. May everyone who's having this feeling be relieved of it by my death. I mean, that's a great habit to cultivate. Yeah.
I thought about that also, and I completely understand your question, and I think your answer is right on. And I also think that by thinking about the karma and looking at your own daily life and propensities and things, it helps you to focus on purification. So mm-hmm. then you're kind of putting those seeds kind of a little less strong, you're weakening them at least. Maybe we weren't getting rid of them, but weakening. But then I also completely think that my understanding of the teachings is that, yeah, you don't know what's going to come up, and we don't have that great of control of our mind. But this is, to me, one of my biggest motivators, is the reason I would work on my mind in my daily life is twofold. One is that it's all about conditions. The state of your mind is the whole condition at the time of death. So if the condition is such, these negative things can't arise from the past. So the two, in my mind, the afflictions are more important than the karma, and that's the teaching.
Yeah.
And that's why. Because those things can't really arise. We don't have that capacity, but we can even see from our own daily life that we have some capacity, and that as we really struggle and work with having a virtuous state of mind and concentration, things like that, that we can impact our day-to-day mental labor. And, so, and as we habituate ourselves to that, then we have more potential at the time of death. If we don't do that, then those seeds that we don't know what's there are likely going to ripen.
Yeah.
When you see how out of control your mind is just in the day-to-day thing, that to me is like the biggest motivator. Because and then putting it in the context of these teachings, you see it's quite a motivation to learn how to be peaceful.
Because
that's the condition that you want. It's peace. Peaceful mind. Peaceful, joyous mind.
Thanks.
So like the heart,
yeah.
Like,
yeah. So we're out of time, actually. It's juicy, though. Okay. So let's sit for a second, and then we'll do the dedication prayer that's on page something. Page 39-ish in the blue book. So just let the thoughts settle. Just think that all of the positive energy that we generated by exploring these teachings, opening our minds and hearts to them and to each other, these also leave a trace that go with us. And in the course of this hour, these hours this morning, have generated a lot of positive potential. So we'll give it away. Just imagine giving it away to every living being, living and dying and living and dying. To share all of this in order to benefit them. Relieve the suffering of every being, not just ourselves. And bring them to greater happiness. Do that prayer on page 39.
Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May the born of no decline but increase for